My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as education lead. And first, I apologize yesterday for telling you to come today to get an early, a spot early. There was a meeting in here, so sorry. But I tell Chuck and Peg, my only problems are good problems, because there's too many people for our spaces. But that's better than not having anybody want to come, right? So good. It's so good to see you come back. And I'd like to welcome back Jason Mon from Augustana, Rock Island, and his discussion on radical Lutherans.
And Lutheran radicals. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mic is on. Great, great. If I get quiet, let me know. If I get too loud, let me know that too. Thanks for coming back. I'm humbled by this conversation and all the energy in this room. So it's just great. Today we're going to talk about Martin Luther. Those of you who either found a copy of the book in the library, or purchased a copy of the book, or stole a copy from your person down the hall, we'll have you bring that out as we go into small group discussion, and maybe you can teach a little bit more things that you saw in that, or do some show and tell, so those that haven't read can benefit from your wisdom as well. And we'll try and carve more and more time for those small group discussions as the week goes on as well, but making it accessible to all, even those who haven't read. The book, for those who weren't here yesterday, the book that I'm referring to is this one, which I co-authored with four of my colleagues from Lutheran colleges and universities. And I think there's still some copies available in the bookstore, and a couple of copies here are in the library that you can just use around the village. Let's begin this morning with a reading from Psalm 22. This is a Bible verse that you probably know in different contexts, including those of you who read Martin Luther's own wrestling with this passage. Jesus wrestled with it too. Psalm 22, I'll read 24 verses. Because this is a psalm, which is a prayer, it will serve as both our reading and our prayer this morning. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me? From the words of my groaning. Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. Yet you are holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. In you our ancestors trusted. They trusted, and you delivered them. To you they cried and were saved. In you they trusted and were not put to shame. But I am a worm and not a human, scorned by others and despised by the people. All who see me mock at me. They make mouths at me. They shake their heads. Commit your cause to the Lord. Let him deliver. Let him rescue the one in whom he delights. Yet it was you who took me from the womb. You kept me safe on my mother's breast. On you I was cast from my birth, and since my mother bore me, you have been my God. Do not be far from me, for my trouble is near, and there is no one to help. Many bulls encircle me, strong bulls of Bashan surround me. They open wide their mouths at me like a ravening and roaring lion. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax, it is melted within my breast. My mouth is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue sticks to my jaws. You lay me in the dust of death. For dogs are all around me. A company of evildoers encircles me. My hands and feet have shriveled. I can count all my bones. They stare and gloat over me. They divide my clothes among themselves, and for my clothing they cast lots. But you, O Lord, do not be far away. O my help, come quickly to my aid. Deliver my soul from the sword, my life from the power of the dog. Save me from the mouth of the lion. From the horns of the wild oxen you have rescued me. I will tell of your name to my brothers and sisters. In the midst of the congregation I will praise you. You who fear the Lord, praise him. All you offspring of Jacob, glorify him. Stand in awe of him, all you offspring of Israel. For he did not despise or abhor the affliction of the afflicted. He did not hide his face from me, but heard when I cried to him. Amen. Would you turn to a person next to you and just for 1 minute, 60 seconds, talk about anything that strikes you about a psalm like that? Thank you. I'm going to continue to cut off conversation well before it's done, and for that I apologize. Of course, we know that psalm primarily because Jesus is quoting it, right? He's so recited the prayers of the Jewish people, his own religious tradition, that they become a part of him, right? So that when he is in pain and feels forsaken by his God, like the psalmist, right, those words are on his lips and in his bones, and they come oozing out, right, as recorded in the Gospels. Walter Brueggemann, famous Hebrew Bible scholar, says that there's really two different kinds of psalms throughout the book of Psalms, what he calls psalms of disorientation and psalms of reorientation. The psalms of disorientation are often called the psalms of lament. They are raw, right? They are like Job crying out to God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? What the F is going on, right? That's good advice. He says that North American Christians and people like Douglas John Hall and others have said this too. North American Christians are so accustomed to associating religion and Christianity with a kind of optimistic, maybe even glib hopefulness, everything will be okay, that they don't have the deep resources they need to name the pain in their lives. But there they are in the Psalms, right? And there Jesus was reciting them. My God, why have you forsaken me? Where are you? Right? Brueggemann says we really need to engage the depths of that despair, that melancholy, that hopelessness, if we are to also hear God's grace of hope and good news. You don't have one without the other. If you only have the second, it's just a kind of hang in there, champ, right? It's glib and it won't touch who we are. And the Psalms are practice in naming the depths of that God-forsakenness, and then moving towards, as it does at the end of this psalm, moving towards that, and yet I know that you are a God of the afflicted, right? That becomes even stronger when we meet Jesus and we know that God's own Son experiences the depth of that pain, that he is not God-forsaken, but God-beloved on the cross, and that anywhere that there is pain then, there is God's presence, God's healing also. And to know God and to know pain are not two different things, but often one and the same. That doesn't mean that we become sadistic or masochistic, right? Flogging ourselves or something else so that we can experience pain. It does mean that we don't have to look away from pain to know God, but we look through it and encounter it and name it and even hold it in ways. In many ways, this names Luther's personal drama as well, right? He thinks that he, at the beginning of his life as an Augustinian monk, he thinks that he needs to move away from sin and suffering in order to be graced by God, right? That grace is a kind of down payment by God that will enable him, empower him to become perfect, to be righteous, to be judged as righteous by God, and that his job is to move away from those things toward a life in the presence of God. He has several cataclysmic encounters with the living Christ that help him reverse this in many ways. And I think Samuel Torvin's chapter that many of you read for today nicely describes this. I'll read the part here on page 26 to 27 that Sam is talking about Luther's reading of Psalm 22. This begins on the second full paragraph for those who want to follow along. In 1513, Luther began his lectures on the Psalms. It was really the first biblical commentary he gave, the first sustained, systematic biblical commentary. We're on the prayers of the Hebrew Bible. In 1513, Luther began his lectures on the Psalms, a collection of poetic prayers that were sung each day in the Augustinian community. It was his study of the first few verses of Psalm 22 that caught his attention. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from helping me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, and by night, but find no rest. In these few words, Luther recognized his own distress, for he too felt forsaken, unable to obtain any answer to his spiritual anguish. His religious superiors and mentors could not help. He prayed, he groaned, but heard no answer from God. And then Luther remembered this, that in dying, Jesus had quoted these same words from the psalm, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? Luther wondered, was it possible that the image of Christ as a remote and demanding judge, the one he was schooled into, that the image of Christ as a remote and demanding judge was inaccurate? Did this brief passage from one of the Gospels not offer a much different portrayal, one in which Jesus also experienced the absence of God at this most critical moment in his life? And could it be, wondered Luther, that if the central figure in the Christian story experienced such terrible suffering in the past, would he not be attentive to human suffering in the present? Luther experienced doubt and anxiety, a visceral sense that he had not worked hard enough to gain God's favor. His body suffered punishing spiritual exercises. His thoughts were marked by uncertainty. His soul was bereft of comfort. His experience mirrored the experience of the forsaken Jesus. Indeed, Luther began to wonder if God were present to him, not in all his fervent efforts to please a stern heavenly judge, but with him at the lowest point in his life. If God were present there, feeling the anguish of his children and God's child, Jesus, would such an experience not mark a radical departure from the idea that God was aloof from human limitation, suffering, and death? Indeed, Luther knew that every artistic image of the risen Christ displayed the wounds left by the nails and spears that marked his body in death. Between his own experience of suffering and his study of ancient texts, his perception of the central figure of the Christian history had begun to shift, bringing a measure of peace. There's several texts of Luther that we'll talk about in the days ahead. Some become really important to the other radical Lutherans, Lutheran radicals that we'll be talking about, including Bonhoeffer, Dorothy Zola, both of whom have been called theologians of the cross. That language comes from this early text. We know the date of the 95 Theses because we're surrounded this year with the 500th anniversary of that. We're actually going to read a few theses at the end of our hour today and talk about not only their theological meaning, but their economic and their political importance as well. Heidelberg Disputation comes a year after that. It's when Luther was not yet in hot water, but was given a chance to kind of mediate, to settle down a little bit, explain himself. It was an invitation to present more academic theses. And by academic, we probably mean neutral, less polemical, right? Theses in the city of Heidelberg. He does just the opposite. He goes for the jugular again and rethinks very, very foundational ways that the church had been doing things and the ways that the church had been thinking for hundreds, if not thousands of years, or 1,500 years. It's in this Heidelberg Disputation where Luther says there are basically two kinds of ways to think about or to be with God. there are theologians of glory. Those who think of God as the highest in a continuum of power, right? There are servants, poor folks, there are middle class, there are military leaders, there are rulers, leaders, kings, presidents, and there's God on top, right? And God has most or all of the power, but the power that God had is basically like, yeah, what these people don't have and what president of leaders of the free world, right, almost have, right, or they're in second place, right? We take our own human conception of what it means to be powerful, which often means to be invulnerable. Aristotle's definition of God was an unmoved mover, right? God is that which gets to affect everything else, but is not affected in himself. Aristotle uses masculine imagery, right? Unmoved mover, moving everything but unmoved, right? Apathetic, not able to suffer, certainly, right? I can make others suffer, but I don't have to, right? That's the image of power, that's the image of God that many of us have, and we project, theologians of glory project that onto God and say God has all that power, right? There's that way of being a theologian, of thinking and being with God, and then there are theologians of the cross, right, who say, if we take this scandalous story of Jesus seriously, God chooses to be fully revealed in a dead Palestinian Jew, right? As one who cries out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? If that's what real power means, what God's power means, it turns it all on its head. Right? And maybe power doesn't mean perfect control. I got the power, you don't. But perfect compassion, right? To suffer with another, right? Perfect sympathy, perfect presence with the pain of others, perfect solidarity with those who are poor and disempowered and suffering. Now, Luther didn't play this all out in political ways. He wasn't a liberation theologian. He didn't think, right, that we should think about systemic evil and economic evil by, you know, traveling to Central America and thinking about people from developing countries, right? That wasn't his frame of reference. But he did, in thinking about theologians of the cross and theologians of glory, give a starting point for other Christians who then keep radicalizing this and keep thinking, if God is found in suffering, you got to be friends with the poor if you're going to know God, right? If that's where God is, then lives of affluence, lives that are detached, lives that aren't compassionate with those who need our passion and our compassion, miss God. We don't know the God of Jesus. We can't know the God. Yeah. If you're unaffected, you're uninfluenced. Yeah. So there's the seeds there. And Bonhoeffer and Dorothy Zola really take this and run with it. Bonhoeffer said, only a suffering God can help. He said this on death row in Nazi concentration camps, right? Only a suffering God can help. That's a radically different form of power than the one we often talk about. Two kinds of righteousness and freedom of a Christian kind of provide the background of a lot of what Samuel Torvin is writing about today. Torvin says that the act of justification possesses a social dimension. And he says that in a number of different ways. What he means is that when one hears and knows God's grace, the fact that one is justified by God's utter stupid love for people who don't deserve it, right? That it doesn't stop there. That kind of freedom isn't then just latitude. It's not, I'm saved, so whatever, right? That freedom, that radical gift of grace and justification, empowers individual to finally stop thinking about themselves and their own status before God, their own salvation, their own justification, and finally enables a person to be present to another, to really find out where there is need and think about how one might respond, to be in solidarity with those who need it. Two kinds of righteousness, as the name implies, is about these two sides of righteousness. Righteousness is that which God gives an individual by God's free grace, right? But there's a second kind of righteousness where that individual then shares all that she has, all that he has with others who need it because they can, right? They're finally freed to actually attend to other human beings. Elsewhere, in a different book, Sam calls this the political sense of righteousness or the social form of righteousness. Luther didn't call it that, but it is a way that righteousness, grace, takes on a kind of communal, social, political paths. It spreads out throughout all of society. Let me pause there before... we get further into what Samuel is writing and some of the economic and political reforms that Luther is making. And for those of you who read, you might name something that struck you in the text. For those of you who haven't, something that I've said or what you've been thinking about, and we'll just kind of do a kind of Q&A here for a few minutes. What's on your minds? I sucked the energy out of the room.
I was glad you read the end of the text, the end of the psalm, because the first part of the psalm is so dark.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then it turns, and in my own life, I have been in the depths of the first part of it, for sure. And the turning is much more subtle in my own life.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
put it that
sure,
way. I still wonder if I've turned that corner some days. But it is hopeful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some psalms have both. They're disorienting and reorienting. Others are only one. It's all lament, and you got to get to the other psalm. One point that Brueggemann and others make, though, is that they don't cancel each other out, right? Unlike a kind of glib happy ending to a story, right? The praise psalms don't do away with the lament psalms. When Jesus gets up out of the tomb, the wounds don't go away. Right? It's not as though death is overtaken. Well, it is overtaken. I don't know. Death is held in the life of God.
It's not erased.
Right.
He still experienced death. He went through death.
Right. Death is in the life of God.
Yes.
And therefore redeemed. But not ignored. Right?
I have a question about just as Luther, contemporary Lutheran theologians, the stuff about freedom of the Christian. I think for people nowadays who were, like, most of my congregation were raised very evangelical or fundamentalist, and so that's really good news for them that you don't have to worry. Like, mm-hmm. you are, just by nature of God's grace, you're justified. Mm-hmm. You can let that project go. So mm-hmm. for them, that, like, sounds like really good news. Mm-hmm. They're the perfect audience for this message. But I guess I wonder, as a Lutheran theologian myself, how does this message play for people who aren't bothered with the idea of, am I saved? Am I in right relationship right. with God? Am I justified? I mean, there are times, Dave Lowe says, Lutherans, you know, we've got really amazing answers if you happen to have 16th century questions. So I think there still are people for whom that's like really good news, but I think a lot of people out there, that's not what they're bothered by.
Right.
And so I wonder about how is this promise articulated for those, mm-hmm. how is it spoken as good news for those who aren't bothered by
yeah.
it? I don't know if you have an answer.
That's great. I don't have an answer. I think it's a great question, a great comment. I do think that one of the biggest difficulties of the contemporary church today, and maybe Lutherans in particular, is to distinguish grace from privilege. I live an incredibly privileged life, right?
Yeah.
for me, most of the time, being loved by God sounds like just more of the same privilege, right? I mean, I'm also a tall, straight, white male. Why do I need to be loved by God too, right? I'm serious, right? I mean, I live a life of incredible privilege, right? And that word of grace doesn't hit me the same way it hits somebody who needs it like water in the desert, right? But I think the calling for me, and this goes more to your question, I think the calling for me is, if I am to understand grace then, I can't only surround myself with people like me. Like, I just am going to get, I'm going to confuse grace with privilege. Unless I'm by those who need it most and learn to see grace from their perspective. I think this is what liberation theologians generally say to first world peoples is, come and see. Like, if you want to know God, you gotta be with the poor.
But I also wonder if by doing that, you don't end up having a whole new lens as to why you actually, as a privileged person, do desperately need grace.
Right, right.
I mean, what a better way to be confronted by your own systemic sin.
Right, right, right. And that's a call to repentance, right, yeah, knowing that. And that I am the perpetrator of other people's pain, right, is something, right? I am complicit in systems that keep inequality in place, right? Thank you.
But just because you live in privilege doesn't mean you don't have pain. There's pain.
That's right. That's
there's
right.
Pain in this room. Yeah. And, you know, right. Even when we come to Holden, I see a lot of peripheral talk, you know, weather, nice hike today, blah, blah. But we don't talk about the pain that we have at home or the death of a loved one or other worse off stuff that's going on in our lives. And, you know, I constantly, you know, even when I'm here, ask people, you know, what's their story, and try to get into their life a little bit, because otherwise we just go away and we had a retreat. I remember when I was a young person, we went to a retreat. The key things were like the small group discussions where some kid said, hey, I have this problem, and how do you wrestle it? How do you pray about it together? Mm-hmm. I, you know, as I just mentioned that because I like those conversations here and in other places. Youth group meetings, you know, or in home group meetings, where people really put it on the line and say, hey, look, I have, because just because you're in this room and you're white privilege or whatever you want to call it, you still have problems and you still have deep, deep needs. They just get kind of washed over sometimes, and you don't talk about it. And you don't talk about your need for God, but you do. You know, even when we were in El Salvador, you know, they have a need for God, but they're happy as a clam. And why? They have the faith in God. So faith in God gets you over those tough times. But I would encourage more conversation about the really things that really hurt and how God has walked you through it. Because when you tell me how God walked you through it, then I go, oh, okay. Then when I go through that, I understand.
Thank you for that comment. It's wise. It really is. Yes.
We also live in a culture that doesn't give us a lot of permission to have pain. Have ways of avoiding it.
Yeah.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. So this gentleman said we also live in a culture. What's your name?
Bob.
I don't have to call you a gentleman. Bob, who may or may not be a gentleman, said that we live in a culture that doesn't give us opportunity to talk about our pain.
Yeah,
is that
it's
right?
Like, get over it.
No. Yeah.
Feel bad, get over it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, thanks. One more comment, and then we'll do a little bit more.
I've sometimes been impressed within my own congregation that you spend a lot of energy looking towards the needs of the others, and sometimes it neglects the needs of the congregants and for each other. So we sort of hide a little bit behind, oh, we've got all this work to do over here. Mm-hmm. And then again, I look around in that room, and I, by just virtue of knowing what's going on, recognize some huge loss or pain that maybe isn't being addressed because we're focusing away.
Yeah. It's great, great comments and keeps us in check. Yeah. Even Mother Teresa, right, moves from serving the poorest of the poor in Calcutta to serving people in the United States, and says that in some ways the pain is much more graphic, much deeper here. The loneliness, even and maybe especially among the affluent in the United States, right? There's real pain there too. So yeah, it's not a zero-sum game. Don't think about us because we got to be in El Salvador or something. But that God has revealed where pain is something that fundamentally changes the way Luther thinks about his own spirituality and helps frame some of what becomes a Lutheran piety or a way of being faithful in a Lutheran lens. I would like to read a little bit more from Sam's contribution to this book. And then maybe we'll have some small group time talking about Luther's own work for justice and for social reform and all the ways that his theological ideas had really practical ramifications for the distribution of money and food and education and these things. I'm going to read from page 32 to 33. This goes over and quotes from Two Kinds of Righteousness. And I'll see, I think I have a copy of that short text, it's a sermon, by Luther on my computer, which I've been given special permission to use for purposes of our class. I'm not breaking any eternal rules here. And I could make some copies available if people need even more to read this week or on their way home or whatever. It's a beautiful, beautiful sermon. Freedom of a Christian is like it in many ways. Both are talking about justification as freeing us from our work, our desperate work to earn our own salvation, but also freeing us for a life of radical solidarity with those who need our attention and our service and our work for justice. Both of them are patterned after the Christ hymn that we read yesterday in that sense. Okay, I'll begin at the top of page 32 here and just read a page and a half, and then we'll do some work in small groups. In the same year, this is 1519, Luther preached on the two forms of Christian righteousness, setting forth the teaching on justification by grace. The first and primary form, quote, is alien righteousness, that is, the righteousness of another, instilled from without. This is the righteousness of Christ by which he justifies through faith. This righteousness, then, is given to men, by which he means men and women, in baptism and whenever they are truly repentant. Just as a bridegroom possesses all that is his bride's and she all that is his, so Christ and the church are one spirit. That was really Luther's leading atonement theory. His understanding of what happens in the cross was really erotic in many ways. We might talk about sex later. Is that right, Nadia? Maybe. Okay. It was erotic. It was what gets cleaned up and called the happy exchange, right? But it's about consummating a marriage, and you know the place where Jesus stops, right, and we begin is hard, right? Right? You get the point, right? It's about one flesh, and all that is Jesus is ours: righteousness, grace, peace, and all that is ours, pain, sin, suffering, is his. And we share it. It was not like a magical theory about, you know, some debt that gets paid, you know, and all the accounts are even. It's just like when you are that close, when the incarnation is that deep to the point of the cross, you can't say where Jesus stops and where you begin. It's one flesh. That's what redemption means for Luther. Or that was his favorite imagery for it. Sorry, back to Torben. Luther both connects and contrasts this alien righteousness to a second form, or what he calls one's proper righteousness. Interesting. The second kind of righteousness is our proper righteousness, not because we alone work it, but because we work with that first and alien righteousness. Remember from Philippians, right? Work out your own salvation in fear and trembling, for it is God who is at work in you, right? This is not our own work alone, right, but we work with God's work. And then the alien righteousness becomes proper, takes shape, gets some form. We work with that first and alien righteousness. This righteousness consists in love to one's neighbor. Here Luther, this is back to Sam now. Here Luther offers a Pauline interpretation of the command to love the Lord your God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself. In effect, Luther argued that God is always advancing toward human beings with grace and mercy. This advance continues in the world of daily life through Christians called to love and care for the neighbor in need. No longer, argued Luther, need one assist the neighbor in order to gain supernatural advantages while using the neighbor for one's own personal gain, right? If I love the neighbor so that God loves me, I'm not loving the neighbor, right? It's a kind of roundabout way of loving myself at best, probably not even that. Rather, the Christian is called to share that which he or she has already received, the grace and mercy of God. In other words, the theological claim, Christ's righteousness is offered freely and without condition, holds a social mandate. Quoting Luther, as love and support are given you by Christ in Holy Communion, you in turn must render love and support to Christ in his needy ones. You must feel with sorrow all the unjust suffering of the innocent with which the world is everywhere filled and to overflowing. You must fight, work, and pray. End quote. While the theological claim can be distinguished from its social implication, the two cannot be separated. Luther was clear in his argument. What Christ freely gives must be extended into the world through the actions of Christians, through their commitments to the well-being of others. God does not need this action, but the neighbor who suffers does. In other words, the abundant love of Christ becomes palpable on earth and in human life through the works of justice and peace. Back to Luther. We work with the first and alien righteousness. Indeed, Luther could never have imagined that love be reduced to one's feelings for another person. Christ was not put to death because he had loving feelings for others, though he did have those feelings, but because his love energized his commitment to the life, health, and salvation of others, a commitment made tangible in word and action. Rather than spend one's life and energy working to gain the favor of God and the reward of immortality in heaven, Luther argued that the Christian could direct those energies towards life on earth, toward the amelioration of suffering and the diminishment of injustice. This was a complete reversal of the spiritual world, the spiritual economy, he calls it elsewhere, the spiritual world in which Luther was raised. Rather than striving for union with God, he argued, the teaching on justification by grace claimed that God is the one who seeks out humans wherever they find themselves in the world. Sorry. Let's get in some small groups, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever you feel comfortable with, and look at these questions that end the chapter. I think especially question 2, 3, and 4 are pertinent to everyone, whether you've read or not, just based on what we've said. So I'll read those three out loud. If you have a member in your group that has a book, you can look at the book more and look at those questions more carefully. So this is 42. Thank you, Penny. Question 2 reads, in Two Kinds of Righteousness and Elsewhere, Luther argued for the inseparability of an individual's reception of God's grace and her work for social justice. Do most Christians consider these inseparable today? If not, why not? The second question, according to Torven, one important result of the Lutheran Reformation was the first state-funded initiatives for food assistance, job training, healthcare, and so forth. Those of you who have read can maybe fill this in a little bit more. Do you find state-sponsored policies and programs to be more or less important than the efforts of individual Christians and congregations? Which are more radical, and in what sense? One point that Sam makes is that really, with the closing of the monasteries in those areas of Germany that were influenced by the Reformation, by the Magisterial Reformation, those communities lost the social support that they had from the monasteries. It was the nuns and the monks The nuns and the monks. That was a little gender bending there. The monks and the nuns who were giving food and support. Yeah, they were living out the gospel with the poor, right? And when they fled to be with the reformers, these evangelicals, they lost that support and they had to reinvent it. They did it not by creating another religious community by that, but by saying that, no, it is civil society. It is all the people who are responsible to care. So they developed a common chest where people could get zero interest loans when they needed it, right? Luther lobbied for the education of all boys and girls, very, very radical at the time, so that they could read the Bible and other literature and be educated. There was free health care for those who needed it, food assistance programs. And Luther really, really pleaded with all communities that this is not something that individual Christians do or even individual congregations. The whole city does that. And all are taxed in order to support the poorest, right? Perhaps these are still controversial ideas, right? But the question is about the church's relationship to cities and governments, right? And who cares and how Christians enter into that work. Finally, there's this question. Many today assume that the Christian faith is perfectly compatible with various economic systems. For example, a global free market economy. So I can be a capitalist and I can be a Christian, and those are just two different identities that are perfectly compatible. How does Luther's distrust of the emerging mercantile capitalism of 16th century Europe challenge these assumptions? He thinks that the emerging capitalism is based on greed and that it should be resisted, and that usury, charging interest when you give money, is against the will of God. How do you respond? There's the question, capitalism and Christian identity, Christian faithfulness. Turn to some folks, talk about whatever strikes you there or anything else, and then we'll have some time to report out.
Sure.
Thanks. Taking off. Yeah. Samuel Torben's good. Yeah. What is the...
Okay, so what I didn't realize is that the state church, the church still runs some of the schools,
yeah, right,
and the daycare center, right, and the hospital. Yeah. To the extent to which, if you want a job at a hospital,
because I want to be a state employee. And it's even more like in Denmark was the last to really dissolve this state church alliance, but they still culturally they still right. I would say, though, that in this country, we have none of that political arrangement, but culturally, it's still, I mean,
Laura, my spouse, right, when there's unchurched... All right, gang. If we could come back together and continue talking for a couple more minutes. Okay, here's a deal, and I have to strike this deal because, one, I was a bad timekeeper today. And we just have about 6 or 7 or 8 more minutes here. And second, because I forgot my 95 theses upstairs by in there. And so we won't do that work today. Would it be okay if we begin our time together tomorrow reading a few of the 95 theses and then leave Luther for Bonhoeffer and we'll make something of a transition at that time. Okay, so we'll begin with 95 theses, just a couple of them, and think about their economic and political importance as well as their theological importance when we begin after a short Bible reading tomorrow. Great. So let's spend the last 7 minutes or so just hearing what your groups talked about, what strikes you, what you want to challenge, what you're wrestling with, whatever else. Man, I've had this effect today.
Well, I was going to say, we shared within our group the question about balancing the individual or needing to establish organizations, relationships within our communities to meet needs. And two of us, at least, were able to express the level of expertise it needs to deal with some of today's problems. Mm-hmm. And I work in an ER where we see a huge amount and greater growing mental health issues. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge, huge step to be able to find housing for these people, skilled housing that can encourage a dialogue between needs, you know, those types of things. So I think that we really do need to work to allow the building of expertise for this kind of difficult work.
And it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And the only way to raise those funds, realistically, is through, you know, democratic process and taxes. I mean, in my opinion, I mean, people might have other opinions, but it just takes a lot of money to raise the level of care and to support, you know, children.
Thanks. Who else?
One of the things we talked about was how surprising it was to us to learn that Lutheran was such a social activist. I mean, he has done so many things that are so needed today, and that we see in our political structure folks saying, well, this isn't really something the state should be doing. This is something private industry should be doing. Individuals need to take care of themselves. And it's sort of, our Bishop Dave said in his speech to the Senate Assembly recently that we have to distinguish between being political and being partisan, and that we're all political by nature, that it's part of what the church's mission is to be involved in the political, the polis, he said. Mm-hmm. But it's the partisan pieces that drive us apart when we're saying, you know, those folks are doing it for their reasons, or, you know, we aren't thinking about the whole group, and so we have to be careful about those things and try to work toward a solidarity with everyone.
Thanks. Just getting back to your first comment about not realizing Luther's work for social justice. We should be clear, too, right? I mean, Luther is a fallen individual, as we all are, and he came up dramatically short in many, many ways, right? The big examples are Jews is probably the one on the tip of our tongues all the time, and it should be, right? He perpetuated a kind of anti-Jewish and maybe anti-Semitic, and you can distinguish those sentiment, especially at the end of his life. He really thought that once the gospel was freed from what he thought was the containment of the Catholic Church, the Jews would convert, and became really frustrated when they didn't, and that angered him. Also, his response to the peasants' revolt, a number of years after writing these pieces, right? Peasants thought, okay, freedom of a Christian, right? And we're no longer paying taxes that are supporting the rebuilding of the basilica in Rome, right? Luther is a kind of political leader who's going to free us from the empire, right? And give us local autonomy over our land and ruling ourselves. And there's an uprising, a violent uprising against the princes, and Luther advises the princes to stab, smite, and slay a rebelling peasant, right? This is not, right, a person on the ground necessarily, right? I mean, he is privileged, he's highly educated, he picks fidelity to the princes over fidelity of the peasants at a critical moment in a way that he comes to deeply regret and repent for, too. And that's one happy ending to that part of the story. So yes, all this work for social justice also coming up short and not being able to see those who are most vulnerable and to hear them and see them. Let's go here next and then back here, okay?
Yeah. How all that should work. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, there's different systems too. I mean, within the state, even what she was talking about, partisan versus politics. If you have someone who's saying, like she said, it's not the state's job to, you know, these people need to work harder. It's not the state's job to feed them or whatever. That's a political position that seems to be directly in direct opposition to other political positions that say, we don't know their background. Maybe they can't work harder. Maybe they have worked harder and it's still not, you know, whatever. We do need to help them. So that's not partisan, I think, so much as just an almost irreconcilable political difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the greatest challenges of our church today is not Jew nor Greek, male but female, but conservative and liberal, or right and left. I mean, we are called into one body of Christ, right? And how, I mean, that difference, that those political differences have become so divisive, right? That can Christians be in one body of Christ if there is a liberal church and a conservative church? And that difference means more than we both look to Jesus to see and know the love of God. It's tough. It's tough. Let's go here and then back here, and then we might be at time.
Well, I mean, just this morning, I mean, my family of five had an inordinate amount of discussion about how we're going to proceed throughout the day. I mean, this is, I mean, we're a country of like 300 plus million, yeah, trying to figure out how to like clothe people, shelter people, provide health care for people. And I mean, it was kind of brought up in our group. I mean, like, what's the federal government's responsibility, the state, you know, the different levels? And like 500 years ago, did Luther envision, you know, the size, yeah, and complexity of our, and I mean, I'm an unabashed socialist, so I mean, I'm totally with him, but how do we do that today?
Yeah, yeah. That's right. And I think one response to that is it's got to be small scale, right? And we're not going to start over as a country, you know, as a Western civilization or something like that. You can gather people around a cross, right? And be political in the deep sense. Live a politic, right? Have a polity, have a way of forgiving one another and caring for the vulnerable that matters, right? And maybe it's only that prophetic stance, right? That there are different ways of being with one another that is Christian's calling. Right? I don't know. It's a great comment. Last comment here.
I think we also have to look at the issues of power. We're seeing that with Luther. I mean, to make his break with the church, the princes supported him.
Right, right.
When it came to the peasants, he's kind of, you know, looking to the fact that he owes them something. And I think we do that a lot of times in our search for social justice is we align ourselves sometimes because we need that power with strange bedfellows that later those things shift, and we have to continually look at what the power call is. Mm-hmm. And even in the family of five, I know we're looking at the same thing. We have the power when it finally comes down to saying, no, this is what we're going to do over the kids. And it's those shifting and understanding when we have the power and when we don't have the power, but how we tap into that power and how we
make that more just, because it's all about the fact that it goes to our heads. And even though the early church set it up as this communal thing, that Luther really brought us back to understanding as a society that holds all things in common and shares, that something in our human nature keeps causing us to unravel it every time we set it up. And even when we started on small scales, how do we get it to spread, and how do we change that human nature, and how do we work with God, because that's that part, I think, where God is coming in and helping us address our power issues that keep us from being able to keep that going.
Wonderful. Yeah. One of Luther's kind of key doctrines, understandings of the faith, is that we're simultaneously sinners and saints, right? That our saintliness, our justification, the fact that God loves us unconditionally doesn't displace the muck that is our life, right? Both the pain and the sin in our lives. I hope that that's freeing, right? That knowing that our ultimate status before God is not dependent on getting this right is freeing, to be creative and take chances, try things, and when they don't work, try other things, right? Maybe take two steps forward, one step back, because ultimately it's not going to be perfect, but we can work for justice in a very messy world, because ultimately that world is already redeemed, and it's not dependent on our work, right? Thanks. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I just want to tell you one story that a person told me. I live in Minnesota, and they were driving to work, and every day as they got off to go to their place of employment, there was this man sitting there saying, you know, he needed food, he needed help. And so, you know, people would give him money. And so this woman who worked there as a mother thought he probably just needs food. So she goes to McDonald's and buys this huge meal. She gives it to the man. She said, "You're probably hungry." And he took it and he threw it in the dish, and he said, "Hell, lady, I make more money in a day than you do. I make at least $200. You know, and I thought, okay. He got into power. He probably did better than anyone else. It was just his way of seeing work, and then it made the rest of us angry, you know, and things like that. But I thought,
that is a real discredit to the people who really are hungry, who really do have issues, though.
And so how do you know?
You can't know. That's not yours to know.
That's where you have faith. You just give because you're giving. I mean, my wife would give away 10 times.
But it was just hearing his answer that I had never ever heard about. You know?
This is one of those moments where we say, continue the conversation. Over coffee, thanks for being here today. You're wonderful, and hope to see some of you tomorrow. Yeah, thanks.